Älskar du den här podden? Stötta den genom IKAs nya supporterfunktion. Det är helt upp till dig hur mycket du vill bidra med och det finns ingen bindningstid. Klicka på länken i poddbeskrivningen för att visa din uppskattning och stötta podden.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I was there for about 9 or 10 months, I think, over winter. So it was extremely dark. And it was, but the first, like you would work there, the first thing you would do in the morning would, you would get on the four-wheel drive and go and pick birch leaves and moss and all sorts of enbar, juniper things. And yes, so it was such a different way to work. And it was so small amount of guests and everything hand-picked and very much done to order. It was beautiful. Mm. But then at the same time, it was somewhat frustrating that you had this enormous window in the kitchen looking at Oreskutan. So you were working really hard, but you were looking, and I think that was where I really made this transition. I was running a little bit prior to that, but living up there and running almost every day in, we lived in a village called Huso on the backside of Oreskutan. So I was running quite a lot around the mountains and the trails there, and then in the end it got a little bit painful going to work and looking at the mountain all day long.
I first met Billy White at a book release event at Rosendals Trädgård, where I was asked to perform a short Q&A with the authors. Billy, one of the authors, is also the head chef at Rosendals. The two books being released was Moon Valley Diaries by Emily Forsberg, Ida Nilsson and Mimi Kotka, and Billy's own book Eat, Run, Enjoy, both now available on Gavel Publishing. Billy White was a perfect fit for Husky, a passionate and dedicated runner with a very interesting specialty. He is a top chef with experience from the kitchens of Guide Michelin star restaurants such as St. John in London, Noma in Copenhagen, restaurant Mattias Dahlgren in Stockholm, and the almost mythical Fäviken in Åre. Billy is also nominated as Trail Runner of the Year 2019 by Trail Running Sweden. My name is Magnus Ormestad and this is episode 31 of the international series of the Swedish outdoor podcast Husky. Husky is made possible thanks to Naturkompaniet. If you want to know more about this episode, get all the links to Billy's book Eat, Run, Enjoy, head over to huskypodcast.com. You can also find Husky on Facebook and Instagram at the handle Husky Podcast.
Yes.
So I just saw that you're nominated on Trail Running. What's it called?
Trail Running Sweden.
Yeah, Trail Running Sweden. They've nominated you.
Yeah. I was a little bit of a. I was tagged into a post and I wasn't really sure why, and then when reading down I was
I saw a familiar face
yeah. I can't remember what was it called Prestation,
yeah,
which is really nice. It's nice to be noticed, I suppose. Nice,
yeah. To, yeah. But you have been affiliated with them for some time, right?
Yeah, I started just over 2 years ago. I contacted them to see whether they would be interested in in working together or doing printing some recipes and somewhat of like a journal kind of like training the food I like to cook and eat with training, plus maybe a little bit of race reports and yeah, what's coming up and something a little bit more like race reports. I read because I'm a bit nerdy, but they can be a little bit painful, so it was nice to mix it up with food, which is hopefully a little bit less painful to
But was that, now I'm jumping ahead of myself here, but was that kind of the start of your book project?
Yeah, it was after a few months of doing these recipes, then I got contacted by the publishers, Gavel. And And here we are, exactly. Yeah.
Where is home to you?
Oof. I mean, currently, what do you say, wherever I lay my hat. But I live in Aspuden, Anspire, just south of Stockholm, and I mean that's where my wife and two kids, and I've been here for 10 years, so so it's home, I guess.
Yeah.
But I mean I don't know, spiritually, I don't know, it's hard to say. I've moved around a lot in my life. This is the longest I've been anywhere since I was a kid, so it's hard to, it is home, but there's other places. I've spent a lot of time in the Alps when I was in my early 20s, snowboarding and doing ski seasons, and I spend a lot of time, quite a lot of time in the Lake District now. I come from York originally in the north of England, so that's
that is another home.
Yeah.
What was it like growing up in York?
York is pretty nice. Like, I grew up just outside a small village. I went to a nice school in the, it was fun. Like, it's a fairly boring landscape. It's pretty flat in the Vale of York, but there was, like, we, I don't know, typical growing up in the '80s. We were out a lot on the bikes and having fun and getting up to no good. And
but is it asphalt concrete? Was that a big part of your childhood?
Asphalt? No, we. I mean, the village I grew up in was surrounded by a farmer's field, so we spent a lot of time, like, out playing football. I was obsessed with football for a long time, and then as like I got into my sort of early teens, I became really into skateboarding. So I spent a lot of time traveling from the age of like, I don't know, 13, 14, going into to York, the centre, which is this historical old Viking city, so terrible for skateboarding.
Like cobbled
streets. And yeah, so and then travelling around a lot, like that was the main thing I did for quite a lot of years. Yeah,
like not professionally, but as a lifestyle, sort of.
Yeah, definitely. We knew a lot of people in like the north of England, is as much as it's a lot of people, it was quite a tight, you got to know people in the surrounding towns, and yeah, it was definitely a lifestyle. And
I'm guessing that was your ticket into snowboarding as well.
Definitely. So as soon as I went, my first experience on snow was at a dry ski slope in Sheffield. Which is like
the plastic one,
the plastic, yeah. Extremely painful.
Yeah, I can imagine to fall on.
Yeah, horrific. I did a snowboarding lesson when I was, I don't know, 14 or something, and then the next opportunity was when I not long after I started cooking school, I stopped doing catering school and went and did a ski season in Meribel instead.
Where?
In Meribel, in the Three Valleys in France.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
But when it comes to like sports and stuff, that was, you were more of the skater kid than the football club kid.
I played football for some years until I found skateboarding. I think it became I tried every. I'm not good when it comes to coordination. I was terrible at football. I was pretty terrible at skateboarding, really. And tennis, I was terrible at, and a bit stubborn. But I enjoyed these things, but I was definitely not naturally gifted at.
But I can imagine that we talked about skateboarding before this interview, and since I grew up in the forest, I'm not a skateboarder. but so I have no experience when it comes to that. But I can imagine that it's, when it comes to, if you would look on skateboarding as a workout, it can be a pretty tough workout.
Definitely, yeah. Definitely.
And you're staying fit with a skateboard, right?
Yeah, for sure. I'm like, we would be, especially like, in like late teens, you'd get out at first thing in the morning and skate all day long, or like literally, like yes, it was a super workout. There's not many unfit skateboarders, that's for sure. Maybe the lifestyle outside of skateboarding could leave some something to be desired, but the skateboarding is a really good exercise.
Here in Sweden, we have the term friluftsliv. As you know, what was your relation to friluftsliv, like life spent, like spending life outdoors as a kid or as growing up?
We didn't really have one, to be completely honest. It wasn't. It was as when I was very, very small. My parents come from London, and they moved up before I was born to York, and my dad struggled to get work in the early 80s when it was and he spent a lot of time, like, as I was a very small child, we spent a lot of time walking the dogs around the village and outside into the fields, and he used to hunt with dogs when you were allowed coursing for hares. So I'd often wake up in the morning and there'd be like rabbits and hares hanging from the back of the door, and so like we definitely had some sort of relationship with that side of things. And then when my parents split up, and I don't know, it wasn't something that we spent too much time with, unfortunately, I think.
But what are your thoughts now? Because you have two kids now in Sweden, even though they're still quite small. But your thoughts on the Swedish outdoor life, like it's because it, at least it used to be, especially for me growing up, it was definitely a big part of our upbringing. Do you think that's very if you look at it as an Englishman?
I think it's fantastic. Like, I really enjoy the fact that we're like here. You see so many people outside. You pick the kids up in the pouring rain in the pitch black at förskola, and they're outside. And they're like at the förskola that Mimi, our daughter, goes to. They have a terrible uteplats, so they go two times every day. They're out in the woods and around. And I think it's fantastic. And my wife, she comes from Sundsvall. Her family are all from Jämtland, and they're like hardened freelufts lifers.
That waking up as a kid to find dead hares hanging from the door, was that kind of something that later became your career in the kitchen?
Not really. At the time, my parents were not so interested in cooking. More into killing. But the hares would go to the dogs, and it was a different time then. So I think people thought about things in a different way, kind of. My parents weren't particularly interested in food. My grandmother, who lived in the same, my grandmother and grandfather moved up from London at the same time. Mm-hmm. So I spent a lot of time with them, and they were. She was a fantastic cook, but very simple food, like pie and mash.
Shepherd's pies.
Yeah, exactly. But like with everything made from scratch, fish and chips on a Saturday lunchtime with the little deep fryer, and like, but really good, good, solid. Mm. And I think that sparked some sort of interest, definitely. But the idea of becoming a chef was definitely, that was more accidental than.
Was it like... I'm not familiar with the British school system, but like choosing what classes to take in high school, for instance, the prejudice would be that if I study something like
catering,
it's like, yeah, it's a simple choice.
Yeah.
Was that the case for you?
Yeah, I think it was a little bit like it wasn't
more than passion.
Definitely. And it was easy. It was definitely, nobody in the top of the class was aiming for catering school. Absolutely not. You can tell that by the classmates. And I mean, I wasn't academically, I'm not at all academically suited. But I'm too hyperactive. I get bored very quickly. It's the same when I went to SFE 3 times. I couldn't handle it at all. It was just so
Swedish for immigrants.
Yeah, exactly. Which, as you can see, by we're doing this English, it's interview in English. It's, but what was I saying? So cooking was. I signed up. My intention was to do A levels, which I guess is the schooling system. You finish school at 16, and then at the time it was a optional 2 years where you could do A levels or you could do something a bit more hands on, like an apprenticeship. Mm-hmm. My intention was to do A levels in sociology, philosophy, and psychology. And about 3 weeks before. Before I was supposed to start, there was a catering, I don't know what it was, like an apprenticeship. You could go and see what the options were, so plumbers and electricians, and there was cooking there, and I ended up putting my name down for cooking. At the time, I'd been working as a dishwasher for 2 years in the local pub and kind of enjoyed it, I suppose.
Like the atmosphere?
The atmosphere was good fun, and working evenings was fun, and it was a... We worked with friends. It was fairly. I never really thought much of it. And then the reality. I spoke to my mother, and the reality that I was never going to sit down and listen to psychology, sociology, and philosophy, age 16 years old, for 2 years. So, I took the step into the kitchen.
But at what point did you kind of realize that you had a passion or a talent for it?
I don't really know. I was fortunate that my first job in the kitchen was a restaurant called Middlethorpe Hall in York, which at the time was really, really good. And I'd never heard of it. It was out of our class. It was a different league. The chef was a young guy who'd worked in 3 Michelin star restaurants in London and was extremely, extremely focused. But I didn't know I didn't even know what a pineapple was. I walked in completely stupid with a giant hat on and a scarf around my neck and didn't know anything. And I did it for I think 18 months, something like that, before going to do the ski season, when I stepped out of the kitchen for a little while and pretended that I had no cooking experience and went back to being a dishwasher, because you had the best time on the mountain when you were a dishwasher.
but coming in. Working in a kitchen like that, was it just chopping onions for 18 months?
It was picking spinach, chopping onions, peeling garlic. It was, but it was also, there was this camaraderie. I know the writer Anthony Bourdain, who recently passed away, he always talked about this like pirate ship kind of, and it was like that. Like it was wild. It was like an eye opener. It was really rock and roll in a way.
But did they also take you in, and like, did you learn something from?
Eventually, I think it took a little bit of time. There was a lot of it was in 1997, I think, and it was a different time. It was tough. It was a really hard place to work. I got paid £60 a week, and I worked 60 hours a week. So it was the equivalent of what, 11 crowns an hour or something. And they cooked beautiful food. At the time, I didn't really realize, but I liked eating all the scraps that were left over and things. But yeah, I definitely learned something. But at the same time, I was so young that I didn't appreciate that I was anywhere good, if that makes sense. I wanted to go snowboarding and I wanted to see friends, and I was a bit upset that I couldn't skateboard as much as I would have liked. So it took some years. I think I was 21. I'd done a couple more ski seasons. And I went to eat in a restaurant in my hometown that was also a very good one. And sitting down and eating this plate of food that was really exceptional, it sort of made me realize, aha, this is why people stand for 12 hours a day getting screamed at by egotistical maniacs. It's because this plate of food, and that changed. So from that point, I sort of stepped away from the snowboarding and the I don't know I'd started to take it a little bit more seriously and became important to me.
But seeing that plate and eating that food, did you start to kind of like kind of decode the plate that you were eating? Like, so they've probably done this in order to get it like that. And, like, did you was that your first experience trying to kind of reverse engineer a dish or something?
I think it was more the food was one thing, the food was delicious, but the environment, sitting there with a glass of wine with people that you like, the environment, a buzzy restaurant, and like you could because I've been to restaurants, but never to that level of restaurant, never experienced something that tasted that good with such good wine and such good. It was sort of the senses awakening more than decoding anything. That came a little bit further down the line, I think.
Like we will focus on running and also eating, of course, and cooking food. But if you would kind of try to describe briefly your career as a chef, because something happened and you've ended up working at kind of spectacular places that not a lot of people working in the kitchen will ever get to work there, so something must have happened. And what drove you to embark on that career?
I think it was like the epiphany moment, having that plate of food. There was a realization that this is really good. This is worth something. This means something. And then from that point onwards, I focused. Really hard while I was at work, and then reading more and learning more. This was sort of pre-internet, really, or very, very basic. It wasn't quite pre-internet, but very basic internet when it came to food. So you would read the Michelin Guide, and you would read certain things, and you'd read magazines and find out. And then it was just a case of I moved up to one other restaurant that was a bit better, and then from there I went to a restaurant that had a Michelin star, thinking that was completely out of the realms of what's reasonable for me. You know, you always think of this as this is an unattainable. Mm. After being there, you realize that it wasn't unattainable. So it opened up that you realized that it was possible to go to these places. It was possible to not just read about these places. You just needed to go. You needed to.
And I guess it's also a matter of confidence. Like now you knew. Now you were aware of that you had skills.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. And also, I was aware that I was missing skills. So it was not to be afraid of stepping into being uncomfortable. Mm. And that was something. I've been uncomfortable all the way through my career, until I got comfortable, and then it was often time to move on.
But what did at that point, like, what did you strive for? You were young, and you were kind of hungry, and you just kind of discovered your mission in life, I guess.
Yeah.
So where did you picture yourself?
Like? I'm not really sure, to be honest. I mean, you read these magazines, or you bought these fancy glossy books full of all these fancy chefs, and it was definitely like, it would be nice to be one, but it was more the food. It wasn't so much the like standing there with three Michelin stars on your chest as this super chef. It was more the food was so important. The food, things that tasted good. It was like it was more about the craft, and then from then would start reading more historical books and learning more about food history, and then different cuisines, and like this endless. I mean, it's still endless now. I have hundreds of cookbooks at home and different cuisines, and you realize that I don't know anything yet. I've been doing it for 22 years.
have you developed, I guess you have developed like a certain style. What is your style, and when did you start to kind of establish your style of cooking?
I mean my style, I would like to say, is kind of common sense. It's a few things on a plate that are quite well selected, that go well together. Try and use the best produce that you can afford, and not mess around with it too much, I suppose. That came. I worked for a chef called Fergus Henderson in London, who coined the phrase in the early 90s, nose to tail cooking, and we used to work our way through the whole animal. So you would use the fillet and the entrecote and all the fancy stuff, but you'd also use the tail and the feet and the everything would be used.
And that's kind of pre. Climate crisis thinking as well.
Yeah, I think so. And but it's also interesting that it's really relevant now, but it was also, it's a way of cooking that's centuries old. That's what people would do. And I think it's so much common sense. So, like, Fergus would never write the provenance of the pork on the menu, or he would never say it comes from this farm or that farm or this is organic. He always used to say, if the diners are coming here, they should trust. We're a good restaurant and we have our standards and we don't need to name drop, because diners at St. John know that we're, and they had to trust us, and we were trustworthy, and it was really nice, that sort of honesty. There was no, I think, so that's something that's lived with me stronger than anywhere else I've ever worked, definitely. And I would definitely say I'm like a disciple of Fergus and St. John.
It's more that style than the, try to think of the name, but this Barcelona chemical,
definitely.
It's you're more into a classic dish.
Yeah, I think
well
so.
Made, but no foam and like dry ice.
No,
kind of
definitely not so much dry ice going on.
I'm just freestyling. Yeah, I don't know if that's the way you do it.
No, but that's how, that was a big thing for a period. Yeah, definitely. But no, it's not for me.
Then coming to Sweden. Like, how did that happen?
I was working at St. John at the time in London, and there was a lot of noise coming from Scandinavia from a food perspective. I had friends who were working at a restaurant called Noma in Copenhagen, and also Fergus won the White Guide International Chef or something, I can't remember the name, and he came over and cooked a dinner at Mattias Dahlgren in Stockholm. So when they came back, they talked very highly of Mattias and the food there and how nice a guy he was. So I looked into it, and I went to Noma in Copenhagen, and I went to Mattias Dahlgren just for some weeks to get a feel for whether I wanted to move on and come to Scandinavia.
Like working in the, like you came there to kind of practice in their kitchen for a while.
Yeah, exactly. And I liked it very much at Noma, but it was a little bit more aggressive, a little bit younger guys who were really pushing to be the best. They were the best. Pushing to be the best in the world, and they became the best in the world. And Mattias was a bit more calm, a bit more Swedish, I guess, a little bit more easygoing, and extremely good quality food. But then also, while I was staying there, I was staying with an old friend of mine, and her best friend is Christine, who is now my wife. So it was somewhere between food and love, which I guess is a good thing to take yourself.
That's the name of your next book, somewhere in between food and love. The Memoirs of Billy White. You can have that as a gift from
Thank
me.
Thank you very much.
If we would talk a bit about similarities and differences between food and cooking in Sweden and in England.
I would say historically the food is quite similar. It's Northern European, it's working cultures. So it's a lot of potato, it's meat, it's heavy.
A lot of brown food.
Yeah, exactly. It's sustenance. And you can see it. I mean, they're different, but they're very similar in ingredient-wise and flavour-wise. And so there's... But, of course, they're different, but not too different, I don't think. And I think England gets a terrible reputation from the Jamie Oliver programmes that were hugely successful over here when they were eating terrible. But generally, the food in Britain isn't all that bad. And the same in... I mean, the food in Stockholm and the food in Sweden is great, or it's also really bad in some places too. So it's very
depends.
Much...
It's all a matter of what kind of story you want to tell.
Yeah, exactly. Right? And the food cultures are both fairly... They're not foodie countries. It's not like you go to Italy or France or Spain where we have these huge cultures revolving around food. I think Britain and Sweden have a similar reference points, similarly new food countries.
Somewhere along the line, you ended up at this mythical place called Fäviken.
Yes, Yeah.
What was your first experience of Fabiken?
I was... we just had our son, and Christine was on Mammaledig, and Fevikin was, there was whispers of this restaurant for a couple of, maybe about 18 months, and you couldn't find anything about it. It was some unheard of strange place. But we'd spent some time in Jämtland, because that's where my wife's family's from, and we drove to Fevikin just to see. And it looked wonderful, and I put feelers out whether they were looking for any staff, and at the time they weren't. And maybe a few months later, we'd been in Jämtland. We spent some time in Åre and at Christine's family in Rödan, and we were just driving back to Stockholm, somewhere around Kista, stuck in a traffic jam for 2.5 hours at the end of summer. Horrific. That time when you don't want the summer holidays to ever end. And all of a sudden I got a phone call from Magnus Nielsen asking, or was interested in, was wondering if I was still interested in a job. So we pretty much turned the car right round and drove back to...
Well, what was it like working there?
It was beautiful. Mm. It was a really beautiful location. A little bit. I was there for about 9 or 10 months, I think, over winter. So it was extremely dark, and it was. But the first, like, you would work there. The first thing you would do in the morning would, you would get on the four wheel drive and go and pick birch leaves and moss and all sorts of enbär, juniper things. And yes, so it was such a different way to work, and it was so small amount of guests and everything hand picked. And very much done to order. It was beautiful. But then at the same time, it was somewhat frustrating that you had this enormous window in the kitchen looking at Åreskutan. So you were working really hard, but you were looking, and I think that was where I really made this transition. I was running a little bit prior to that, but living up there and running almost every day in, we lived in a village called Huså on the backside of Åreskutan. So I was running quite a lot around the mountains and the trails there. And then in the end, it got a little bit painful going to work and looking at the mountain all day long. When
Huså is such a beautiful place, such a beautiful village. And like, you hardly ever go there, but if you do, it's like literally like every house is like, wow.
Yeah. Wow. Really?
And it's so quiet there.
Yeah.
And I get the feeling that it's like the average age is probably like 80.
I think we dropped the age when the three... Yeah. Our son was only 6 months at the time, so he dropped the age quite dramatically. But it was, I think about 80. At the same time, though, there was a brewery that was just opening in the school, Årebrygg Company, I think. Mm-hmm. So that dropped. So there was, all of a sudden, there was an influx of people under the age of 40 moving in, which I don't think had ever happened since the copper mine in 1740.
It's beautiful. But it's like, so if you listen to this and the next time you're in Åre, doesn't matter if it's summertime or wintertime, just go there. It's worth it. It's nice. And very good off-piste areas as well.
So
if you hike up a bit, it's very nice. When did running enter your life?
I was working at Grand for Mattias Dahlgren. I was around 30. I was getting a little bit fat. I had stopped smoking when I left London, and I needed to change. I just felt like it was time to move a little bit. This restaurant life, especially restaurant life in London, is fairly, you work a lot of hours, you spend the time out of the kitchen eating and drinking, and
a lot of pints.
I think I was fueled by Guinness for several years. So it was, I felt like it was time to move a little bit. A friend of mine was coming to Stockholm to run the half marathon, I think in 2011. And I think 3 or 4 months before, he called me up and asked if I fancied running it. And I'd never run more since school. I hadn't run anything. So I'd precariously accepted his challenge and set about trying to run a half marathon.
But how did you... How did you approach it? Like, was it just a means to an end? Like, you wanted to, you realized it, then you needed to get fit. It was about health. It was not about, like, pleasure of some kind.
I think at the moment, at the beginning, it was absolutely not pleasurable. It was just painful. It was certainly. But then also, but it didn't take very long for that pain to subside and start to become a bit pleasurable. I remember the first time running, I think, like, 13 kilometers after work one night, and it was dark and had like pitch black, listening to music, and something happened. Like, I felt like I could go further, and I think, yeah, something happened. It became pleasurable rather quickly.
That was your the running equivalent moment of the time in England when you sat down and had this meal with wine, and you kind of realize, okay, so this is what.
Yeah, yeah, I guess it was. I guess it was.
But what did the running community look like back then? Because the social media had started to become a thing, and you had like trail running and that entire scene. Like, and you were familiar with the mountains from your time in seasons in the Alps and so on. Like, when did you discover, like, trail running and running in the mountains?
At first, I didn't pay too much attention to it. I ran the half marathon, and I survived. And then the natural progression for me was to sign up to the marathon. So the following year, I did the Stockholm Marathon. Whilst training for that, I read this book, Born to Run, which I think a lot of people, there's a whole generation of people inspired, yeah, by Born to Run. And that was really interesting. It opened your eyes to things that you didn't know existed. This level of, like, I think extreme is a fairly horrible word, but this, like, I don't know, people doing interesting things. Mm. And I ran the marathon, and at the same time, one of my good friends moved from York to the Lake District in the northwest of England. And we talked for some time about there's a coastal path, a coast-to-coast path, from St. Bees in Cumbria going to Yorkshire to a small town called Robin Hood's Bay.
Like a marked trail.
It's an unmarked, okay. But like an unofficial, yep, trail of about 190 miles, which is, 300 kilometres, give or take, which translated into 7 marathons in 7 days. So at the time, we decided to we thought we'd give it a go. So we raised some money for a charity, and I think this was in summer 2013, so 1 year after. So Chris has always been a very strong runner and really into the trails and the outdoors, and not so much because I've been so into cooking for such a long time. But we trained, and we started to do this journey. We started this coast-to-coast run. That was a big... That sort of changed everything.
As a chef, did you only see food as something... Was it just flavor and experience on a plate? Did you ever think of food as something more, like kind of a holistic approach to it? I'm thinking of, like, the way runner Billy started to change the chef Billy. Like, if it helped you to kind of start seeing food as something past the plate.
I think it took some time. But it definitely, the thing, and I think it was also during that week, because that was a fairly intense week. Chris had run a lot, but we were definitely not experienced enough to run 7 marathons in 7 days on, I think it was at 10,000 vertical meters over the course of a week for 2 fairly novice runners. So we started off eating like sausage rolls and crisps and sandwiches, and full English breakfasts before starting. There was no like nutritional thought. But then by the end of the week, we realized that salad at lunchtime and fish at dinner time and different things a little bit more lighter, a little bit more nutritious, made a big difference. So I mean, we weren't completely I mean, you always have an idea about the nutritious side of things to some extent, but that week was a very big learning curve.
Started to connect the dots.
Yeah, definitely.
By the way, Pass the Plate, is that the title of your third book?
Possibly.
But you pulled that off, the Coast to Coast Challenge.
Just. It was a hard, it was hard-led, there was a lot. It took a long time to recover, but it was, that was hard. Like the second to last day, we struggled. Chris couldn't run downhill, so he had to walk downhill backwards, walking back down. And it was beautiful. It was an amazing week. We spent a lot of hours outside, which is something that you don't really do, like from morning till night, basically, crossing the whole country.
It's really like earning your spurs. I mean, you could walk up straight after that. Once the fatigue and pain left the your legs,
I think so.
Call yourself a proper runner.
I think. And then after that, that was when I started looking into a little bit more longer distance races and started to think about these ultra runs and trail, more trail. I hadn't run from the 2012 road marathon. I hadn't run a road race really until this year.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What is running for you today? What type of runner are you?
I think for a long time I would have identified myself as an ultra runner or trail runner, but I think now I would just identify myself as a runner. I enjoy running 10Ks on the road. I enjoy running to work and back, but I enjoy running 100-mile trail races or hill repeats on Hammarbybacken, or like I think I enjoy it all. And running on the track on a Sunday morning at 7 o'clock, as much as it's somewhat monotonous, it's kind of enjoyable. I think, and that's something that's really over the last 18 months. And actually, since the beginning of the book, I would get around. I was stubborn and I was capable of finishing, but I was never very good. And I think when the book project came about, I really got something between my teeth that I needed to. I could start. I was confident as a chef. I've worked in good restaurants, and I'm a good cook. I can say that without ego. It's just a fact. Whereas from a running perspective, I don't think I could have said I was a good runner. But I was a stubborn runner who wouldn't. And so in the last 18 months whilst making the book, I've also worked really hard to try and become the best runner I am, because it felt important that if I was to make a book and it's not so much advice in the book, but it's a lot of things are written from my perspective because I wrote it. It was important to me that I was as good as I could be.
Where do your thoughts wander when you run? And is that dependent on the surroundings? Like you talked about doing track sessions or running hill sessions in Hammarbybacken or long trail runs and so on. Is it different mindsets or?
Yeah, I think so. Like the commute to work, I'd try and run 3 or 4 days to work and back. Then it's generally a podcast, and I may as well be sat on the tube. I don't think about anything. I just get to work and get back, and it's kind of nice. But it does allow for, there's some endorphins when I get to work, and there's some endorphins when I get home from work. But and then if I'm running trails, I never ever listen to music. I'm always trying to be a little bit more present, and first from I get to grasp your surroundings a little more, but also for the soul, it's good to think and digest what's going on in life, and yeah.
Just let your thoughts wander, kind of.
Yeah, exactly.
You said that you were stubborn. Is that your, because I sometimes ask my guests what their reactor looks like, especially when it comes to the ultra endurance type of guests. Like if you would try to look into what keeps you moving forward, that kind of, sometimes it's a ball of glowing light. Is it just pure British stubbornness?
I don't know. I think as a, it's a bit of stubbornness. It's a little bit of I don't know. I don't like to think I've got, how do you say, I don't like to quit if I set out to do something. And especially I've got 2 kids and I've got a wife, and it takes a lot of training and it takes a lot of time away from them. And not so, the training I do a lot early in the morning, so I try and negate that. But the, if I go away for a weekend to run 120 kilometers in Högakusten, or then I'm not finishing isn't an option, because I've taken that time away from my family. It's too, it's selfish for me to go. It's even more selfish if I don't finish. And that was the same. Yeah, that's been something. And also, I think I don't want the kids to think of me as somebody who,
as a quitter.
Yeah, I think that's important. Yeah. Well, it's important for me.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to specific goals with your running, is that specific races, for instance, like you said, Högakusten, you recently did Kullamannen, I saw online. Is that your goals, or is it, do you have something else, like I want to be able to do this and that?
I think at the moment, like, I feel quite inexperienced as a runner. So I've run, I don't know, a handful, 10, 12 ultra races and various, but I would like to experience. I enjoy racing. I think it's fun. I'd like to see where, I'm never going to be elite, far from it, but I can be at the front of the next wave, if that, and I think that's kind of nice. And I'd like to race. The experience of racing is great. Long term, I suspect I will get a bit tired of racing, and I'll want to do more like multi-day adventures, or just
like the coast to coast thing you did.
Yeah, exactly. But while time, like with a full-time job, with 2 children, with races are perfect. You can go away, you can do something, you don't have to plan, you don't have to recce, you don't have to, you can just
put the bib on and get into a different mindset.
Yeah, I think so, but I suspect that will have a limit, that will have a shelf life, and from that I would like to be running for years and years and years, and I think that then there will be more adventures, definitely.
I have wrote down a question, like if you have like a before and after when it comes to your own awareness of what you eat with regards to running, and is that the coast to coast challenge with your friend, like when you started to kind of realize that bacon makes me feel like this and salad makes me feel like that?
Definitely. I think I can't say I was particularly strict as a, from a diet perspective, straight after the coast to coast, but that was something. I started to get a little bit more interested in nutrition and a little bit more interested in, or just you put 2 and 2 together, the feeling of, okay, this is good. And also, I eat everything, but there's a lot of, I don't eat too much of a lot of things also. So
for instance,
like I'm not, I eat meat, but maybe two times a week. I like bread, but I'd find that I'd try and eat good sourdough bread, and I'm better if I eat earlier on in the day than too much before bed. I like to drink, but mostly
not during a race.
Not during a race, but I have done that. There's races where they had the Höga Kusten. They had Lättöl at one of the aid stations, which was quite delicious. So it's everything. Moderation, I think, is. And if it doesn't feel good, then it's probably not so good.
This is probably kind of a cliche question, but when does your running end and the cooking and planning for food begin? Have you kind of transcended into a different phase where you where running to the extent that you are running affects what you want to eat and the way the two are interlinked?
I guess to a certain extent, like if it's a big training week, there's cravings for things, and the cravings are generally things that your body needs. I guess it's the same when you're like pregnant women often crave the things that their body needs, and I think it's probably the same if you're having a heavy training week. So I try and sort of preempt these things, and but generally I think it works. Yeah, the body tells you to a certain extent.
But have you always been good at listening to your body, or has the combination cooking and running, has that helped you in a way to be kind of more to kind of listen and know and feel your body better?
I don't know, really. I think I know historically I was not good at listening to my body. When you're working 16 hours a day, standing up, cooking, I don't know, for 100 hours a week, the body is screaming at you quite often to stop. But I think it's taken some time. And it's easy to not listen to your body. I think that's something where you... from a food perspective, especially from a sleep perspective, I think that's something.
And from a working perspective, like only working in the kitchen, I mean, it's a very physical job as well.
Yeah.
So it's also important to listen to your body and signals with that as well. So
yeah.
It's
yeah, absolutely.
But is running affecting your cooking more, or is it vice versa?
I would say that both are somewhat beneficial, I would say. I think if you look at the food that we serve at Rosendal, it's pretty healthy. It's a lot of vegetables. It's not so heavy on nothing is processed. Or if it's processed, it's processed by us, or maybe a cheese here and there and yogurt or whatever it may be. But I think there's a lightness that works well if you run, and there's also like from running to working. I think I'm a better colleague when I run than if I'm injured for a few weeks and I can't run. I think that's all right.
You can handle the atmosphere in the kitchen better. And
definitely.
The way you handle stress and everything, I guess.
Yeah, certainly. And the same with at home. I'm definitely a better father and husband when I'm running than when I'm...
what is the difference between good and healthy food and good and healthy food for running? Like, what do you need to add for it in order to make it, well, this is really good food for running?
I think it's not greatly different. There's one thing. It's one thing. It depends on how much you run in per week. If you're training for a 100-mile race and you're running 100 to 130 kilometers every week, then you need to eat a lot, and you need to eat a lot of the nutrition groups. Yeah. You need a good, healthy, balanced diet. A lot of foods with different colors, protein, whether that's meat or animal-based or plant-based. Ideally, a good if you are a meat eater, then there should be plenty of vegetable, plant-based proteins in the diet also. I think it's very much what's good for you if you run, or what's good for you if you just don't do anything is also good for you if you run, but it's quantities, and maybe things are tweaked a little bit. I know that often iron can be a problem deficiency, so there's like a lot of green cabbage, gran kål or svart kål or different spinaches are quite heavy on the leafy greens is often good. Magnesium can be a shortage, so it's quite high in peppers and aubergines, and you don't necessarily, like, you can take supplements also, and that can be good if you don't have a great food interest, or but it's not necessary either, I don't think.
One thing that I just made that mistake myself, like in this question that I asked you, is that people tend to, we all want general answers, that as if there is a method, a diet, or something that works for everyone. Well, when in fact that doesn't exist now, does it?
Like, no.
Because we're all different, and we've all, like, you've coded your body for this and that many years and so on. So the way you react on your food is probably a bit different from how my body will react to it and so on. So it's
I think that's something when you listen, you hear this, there's a lot, especially in the running world, there's a lot of people who talk about the high fat, low carb, ketogenic, and I mean there's people that seem to be doing really well on that.
Yeah.
I don't know, and I mean, I'm absolutely not science-based in any way. I know from my perspective, I don't think it would work for me. And I wouldn't recommend it necessarily, because I think that carbohydrate is important. But it's what sort of carbohydrate. If you're just eating white bread and white pasta, it's probably not the best way. But occasionally white bread, occasionally white pasta is really good also. It's because it tastes delicious. So if it makes you happy to have a bowl of pasta once in a while, you shouldn't not.
But have you ever, I'm guessing that you have, but have you ever felt like being pulled into, because in this highly polarized day and age, like even the simple stuff, like the way we eat, the way we train, the way we run, what we run and everything is like, oh, so you're not a vegan or a, like you said, the keto, whatever. It's like people are like really taking sides and like, no, this is the way to go. No, that's wrong and so on. And now we have the documentary, The Game Changers, yeah. Kind of sparking a debate, I think. I've seen from my perspective.
Yeah.
Have you ever felt like hijacked or criticized or like pulled into this?
I don't think so. I mean, I watched the Game Changers thing, and it's difficult.
I still haven't.
I think it was difficult to not be somewhat inspired. But then when looking at the like American football players eating deep fried fake chicken, you think maybe it's not so good in the long term either. So it's a lot of propaganda. And there's propaganda from both sides. And you have to, I mean, politics is full of propaganda. Mm-hmm. Everything, life is full of propaganda. So, I mean, and it's a bit of a minefield. So you can easily trick yourself, but I think like standing back and thinking of what's common sense, like I'm never going to be a quarterback for the whatever they're called, Oakland Raiders or whatever, but and I don't know, do you know, like with this, I think if you know where it came from, there's a food writer called Michael Pollan, and he, one of his famous quotes is, eat food, mostly plants, not too much. And I think that sort of reference point of it needs to be real. You need to recognize where it comes from. Mm. If you read the instructions, if you read the, what do you call it, ingredients, and you haven't heard of more than a couple of ingredients, then maybe you should stay away from it. I mean, everybody drinks Coke every once in a while. Everybody has things that they probably shouldn't have every once in a while, and I don't think that's an issue. But I think it's like real food, that comes from, there's another thing that Michael Pollan mentioned about the if your grandparents wouldn't recognize it as food, then you probably shouldn't eat it. And I think there's...
That's a good...
Yeah.
That's a good saying. Yeah,
or great-grandparents, I guess. Yeah, yeah. I think it's... and I think that that's with... Especially with everything is 100%. Either you're 100% keto, I only eat steak every day, or you're a vegan, or it's like, maybe we can be somewhere in between. I don't think we were doing too badly historically.
No.
So...
Mm. And also, I mean... Well, if it works for you, fine.
Like, yeah,
but don't shove it in my face.
Kind of.
This might be a bit cliche as well, so bear with me. But the similarities between, because we're going to talk a bit about your book as well, and you've met some exceptional runners, and would you say that there are any similarities between being a top chef and top, for instance, ultra runner?
I definitely. I mean, it's a lot of hard work. There's no guarantee of success. You have to have a passion for it. If you're just driven by the accolades, or just driven by the shining lights at the top, you're probably gonna be miserable and fail. I think but I guess there's similarities. Every warp of life, if you aim to do something at the very top level,
even if you want to be the best golfer or dart player,
it takes a lot. And I mean, from a cooking perspective, I've worked with many, many chefs who are much, much better than I, and I guess there's many runners, like, I've worked quite hard to achieve what I've achieved, and there's people who work much, much harder to achieve greater things, if that makes sense. So,
but then again, of course, it's kind of hard to compare something, because running, and especially ultra running, is such a physical thing. So it wouldn't be good to your body to go from 0 to 100 miler in like a year, or even 2 years, or perhaps even 5 years or something. It takes time, like physically. So that kind of, that goes without saying that you need to be patient. But I guess it's, isn't it a bit the same with, if you want to work in the kitchen as a career chef, it really takes many, many years to...
Yeah, I think so. I think it doesn't come overnight, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And you can see that there's like the industry is full of... The skill level gets less, I think, as people get... I think there's Instagram and immediate success is there. I think that you feel it from a cooking perspective, you feel it from a running side. A lot of people step up too soon, race a lot of long races, injure themselves, and then they never ever run again. It's a lot of, and I think from a like from a cooking perspective, working for 16 hours a day in London dungeons,
it's not glamorous.
It's absolutely not glamorous, but it was great fun, and I've met some lifelong friends, and I would do it again. But it also translates rather well to ultra running, because you're used to being on your feet.
It's a very physical job. It's not office job.
Yeah.
But this book that you have out now, for how long have you known that it would be published?
We had the first meeting about it, it was coming up to 2 years ago. Mm. So it's been a very long process.
How have you described the book to people during the process?
At first, I mean, it's changed as well, because it's been such a long process. The idea for it was aimed for trail runners to begin with, somewhat ultra trail runners, and as the book grew, that was too marginalised. It was too. So I think it's a book for people who's interested in running and interested in food, which I guess if you're interested in running by default, you somewhat have to be interested in food. But
at least to eat it, maybe not to cook it. At least to eat it.
Absolutely. and from a cookbook perspective, it's always been really important to me that it's a genuinely good book. That's something I've had a big interest in cookbooks over the years. I have hundreds of them, and some of them are good and some of them are bad, and it was really important that I would try and make one that was not just from a running side of things or from a nutrition side of things, but actually have delicious food in that you want to eat. And I hope that that's what
and it achieve. Is your first book.
It's my first book, yeah.
You've met a couple of guests in your book.
Yeah.
How did you choose them? First of all, who are they, and how and why did you choose them?
We met with Ricky Lightfoot, who's based in the Lake District in England, Emily Forsberg, Ida Nilsson, and Mimi Kotka from Sweden, who I guess you've had all of them on.
Yeah.
Yep. And Zach Miller in the United States, and Courtney DeWalter also in Colorado in the States. And basically, we were talking about the trail running world, and there's a lot of special characters and interesting people. Like, it's full of people who live in vans and huts and have done all these crazy things. And initially was the Lake District is a place that's very close to my heart, so going there. And Ricky is a prolific runner, a world-class runner based there, so he also has a family and works full-time, and so it's not all glitz and glam. He works full-time as a fireman and runs to a very high level, which was nice to get that perspective.
And he also has perhaps the best name for a runner, right?
I think so. Ricky Lightfoot is very appropriate. and then I think Emily, Ida, and Mimi, they speak for themselves. I mean, they're next level good runners, like world class. So the opportunity to meet with them was too good to miss. Zach in the States, like, he's a crazy, he's 100% or nothing. He either wins or he fails, helicoptered off the mountain, or he's in such a nice guy and lives at this camp, which is a 10 kilometer 1500 vertical meter hike from the nearest town. Well, we had to hike in food to cook for him and whoever else happened to be camping at the lodge that evening. And and then Courtney DeWalter, she's unbelievable. She's winning 200 mile races, beating the second place man by over 10 hours. So like, she's like crazy. So I made a wish list of people, and basically we had no way of contacting them apart from Emily, Ida, and Mimi, where the publishers have a relationship. I just sent emails on Instagram, and all of them were like, "Yeah, that sounds fun. Come."
but I'm guessing here that their resume as runners was more important than what they eat, or
yeah, I think so. And also from, like, I had no idea what Ricky liked to eat, for example. And I knew that Courtney often talks about the amount of candy that she eats, and Zach through his Instagram was a lot of pictures of burritos and junk food. So, and also Ida and Emily and Mimi, they are very interested in good, nutritious, pretty serious in a nice
farming
way,
and harvesting.
Yeah, exactly, and sort of holistic, the whole lifestyle. So it's really nice to listen to the spectrum. Ricky was somewhere in the middle. Zach's Instagram is much more junk food than his actual real life. And Courtney,
is it kind of an image?
I think it's a bit of an image, but it's
fun, I mean, to provoke, maybe.
Yeah, I think so. And he eats well generally, but he does like to eat burritos, and maybe for
who doesn't?
Yeah, exactly. And Courtney is she's not so food interested at all, but she
candy and beer, right?
Candy and beer, and yeah, but and she eats well, I think. She, but without a great deal of interest. Her and her husband cook, but I think the things she enjoys is pizza and burgers and candy and beer.
Well, she does something right, right?
Yeah, and I think, and that was something that from meeting with the runners and speaking to them a lot about food and how they feel about this, but also about running and how they, it was what really spoke was the enjoyment that they. They loved what they do, and they were very intuitive to their body. They listened to what what their body was telling them. If they felt like they were training too hard, they would pull back. So the food side of things was important from a, but what really came through was how enjoying it was. Not about eating some 2 spoonfuls of green powder mixed with a raw egg, and it was, everything was very real. Yeah. And I think that was something that really spoke.
Mm. Well, I guess like for all of your guests, like, people don't get to where they are if they don't have kind of the whole palais of they need to they need to have a certain understanding and vision and knowledge, I guess.
Yeah.
Be it like aware or unaware, but they need to have the sense, kind of the feeling.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
It seems like we are in a, or maybe it's from my kind of narrow perspective, but there's an ongoing trend with healthy living and healthy food and going back to the roots and everything, especially in the running community. But what are your thoughts on how good the food industry is to match these trend with healthy food, like for instance in the supermarket or whatever, like new products or something?
I suppose I don't. I think it's not so echoed, I suppose. I think there's a lot of I don't know. There's I think if you read or if you like the social media, the running outdoors life, everybody wants to buy a cottage somewhere in the woods and grow their own food and not really work for a living. I think the food industry or the restaurant side of things is it's much more natural than it used to be. Definitely people cook with vegetables. It's a lot more vegetable driven restaurants. There's a lot, like Nicholas Ekstedt is cooking his over open fire, and he has a lot of, so there is some echo. It's hard to say how yeah, linked they are, and especially like I come from a very much a restaurant side of things, and that's a lot about drinking wine and eating. But then the natural wine movement is a lot stronger than it ever used to be. Mm. Organic produces, there's more restaurants that are marked with the Krav stamp or with, so there is some sort of similarities, I suppose, but
do you think that the people are more keen to like to also cook their own food and not only eat in trendy food joints?
I think in big cities like Stockholm is a relatively big city, people like to eat out. Mm. If you like eating out, you like eating out. But I think, I don't know, this place, like Sweden sells what, 4, does one cookbook comes out every day plus a few extra. Imagine. It's a huge, I don't know how many people cook. I suspect the food daily is improving. I know we certainly cook from scratch every single day. That's not so much snap macaroni and scone shotbulla. But it's also time. I think it's difficult if people are working full time. Maybe that's where people daydream. You have two parents working full time. You have to try and scratch something together in a rush. That's nutritious, that the kids will eat. That, I mean, it's a hard balance.
Yeah. And also, I think for many people, it still, I guess, it's for them. It's they see it as kind of a sacrifice in some ways to eat healthy.
Definitely.
How would you want to encourage and plant thoughts for them?
I think it should be, often people think about what you can't eat. I think when you're eating healthy, it's like, oh, we can't eat this because it's bad. But I think if you look at what you can eat, I think that's something, it's almost everything. And maybe, I mean, we cook a lot. We use olive oil a lot rather than butter, so then naturally the food that we cook is a little bit more southern European and quite heavy on vegetables. And and I don't know, like investing in a couple of good Italian cookbooks or Middle Eastern or something, where like we have, like I mentioned before, we have a lot of cookbooks, and there's always one or two in the kitchen, because the inspiration, especially weekday, is hard. Like we plan on a Sunday what we're going to eat for the week. It sounds extremely boring, but it makes a big difference to plan on a Sunday, order in delivery to save a little bit of time. And I guess if everybody gets the food delivered, it's one car journey rather than every family taking a car journey. And we cook, we know what's in the cupboard, we can plan. I think that makes a huge, huge difference, planning in advance. And so it gives the time to be healthy, because you know on a Sunday what you're going to cook on the Thursday.
And it's, I mean, I agree it sounds boring, but it's, and it's kind of sounds like a making it into a big thing, but like, okay, so you have to plan the menu for the entire week and so on. But it's also, when it comes to change of behaviors, it's, yes, it will be a bit awkward and tough the first couple of weeks, 2-3 weeks, but then after a while you get into it, and you kind of hopefully discover the positive benefits.
And like to get home from work, pick the kids up, and know that when you open the fridge, what you need is there, rather than like, oh,
what did I forget?
Yeah, exactly. It takes a little bit of getting used to, but it makes a big difference, because you get that when you have a little bit more time. That's when you find the inspiration, rather than on a Tuesday night when the kids are about to have a breakdown because they're hungry and tired, and the inspiration is definitely not there.
This was your second podcast, and you told me before recording that you will do another one this evening.
Yes.
So tell us about the first experience and the next one. Where can we listen to you?
The first one is an Australian podcast called Cook in the Books. It's a restaurant industry. It's a chef I used to work with who emigrated to Australia. So he talks to a lot of people in the business, and from very high end chefs to wine producers to cheesemakers, and it's quite interesting. He spoke to another ultra runner actually called Patrick, who's a chef in Australia. That's called Cook in the Books. I think it's available wherever podcasts are available. And then this evening I'm doing one with a New Zealand based podcast called Dirt Church Radio, and they speak to all sorts of elite ultra runners and trail runners, and yeah, it's pretty easy going, I think, and
cool,
should be fun.
Where can people find out more about you and get the book? Hopefully
the book is either available on, I have a website, Billy White, and then that little line, dash, is it called a dash, a sideways line, chef.com, where that has some information. I'm quite semi-active on Instagram, BillyWhite43, and also through the publisher's website, Gavel Verlag, I think it's .com. There's plenty of information.
There will be links and all you need on the Husky Podcast website as well after this interview. Anything fun and exciting on the horizon for the coming month? This is not big running months, winter time in Sweden though. But
I've got on Sunday, there's a race called Hammarby Alpine Marathon.
Oh yeah,
22 loops of Hammarby Backen, which I did last year, which was surprisingly one of the most fun races I've ever done.
Wow.
Just because it's a short loop. The start is a bit of a party feel and really low key. Anders, the guy who organises it, is super, super friendly and nice. And it's this year. There's a lot of evenly paced middle-aged men running, so there can be a fun race in the middle of the pack. So I'm looking forward to that.
Good luck on Sunday, and thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me.
Husky is produced in cooperation with Naturkompaniet. The music is made by Joel Mull.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.